You know what I really love doing these workshops with Don. We've gotten to do a few of them together. And I'm always writing notes when he's sharing, right? So I got to finish my note here. Because sometimes he says stuff that he'll never say it again because he just, you know, it wasn't of him. So if I don't write it down, I could be with him for another 10 times and he'll never say that again. So I got to write that down. I'm just kidding. So this idea of fear and how much it owns me and how much it drives me, on page 65 on that three-column diagram that Bill puts in the book, at the end of the third column where he talks about what's affected, fear is in parentheses down the side. And on the next page it says, what about fear? It's bracketed alongside the names of Mr. Brown, Mr. Jones, and the employer. When I come out of my resentment inventory, the one thing that I should probably have learned, hopefully, or the one thing that I was able to glean from my resentments is that I thought I was angry. That's what I thought. I thought I was angry at all these people. But really, it turns out what I was is I was afraid. That self-centered fear is the thing that drives me. Self-centered fear is the thing that owns me. Self-centered fear is the thing that I'm constantly reacting to. That you can write a list of 100 different character defects, and some people do. Sometimes if you go to an open discussion meeting and they ask for a topic, bring up the topic character defects and see how many different things come up, right? Oh, I'm greedy and I'm lustful and I'm angry and I'm spiteful and I'm a liar and I'm a glutton and I'm this and I'm that. But really what I really am, underneath all of it, is I am simply afraid. I simply feel like I'm not enough. I feel like if you knew about me the things you knew about me, you would think about me the way I think about me. And then we could finally both agree that I ain't worth much. And fear is the thing that drives me. And when we write this inventory, this fear inventory, on the top of page 68, it says that we reviewed our fears thoroughly. We put them on paper, even though we had no resentment in connection with them. We asked ourselves why we had them. Why am I afraid? What is it that makes me so squirmy and uncomfortable, so feeling so vulnerable, feeling like I'm not enough, feeling like I can't succeed, feeling like I'm always going to fail, feeling like I'm always going to let people down, feeling like I'm always going to make the wrong decision, feeling like people are threatening me? What is it that makes me feel that way? And I love this next line. It says, wasn't it because self-reliance had failed us? I've lived a life based on self. I've lived a life where all I have really concerned myself with is how I feel, what's happening for me, if I've got enough, if I'm being treated correctly, if you respect me enough, if you care about me deeply enough. I've lived my life based on trying to do everything I can to make myself feel good. And what have I done? How have I acted? I'm afraid I'm going to lose my job. Well, let's look at self-reliance. Let's look at how I've lived my work life to this point. Aren't I the guy that shows up late? Aren't I the guy that tries to leave early? Aren't I the guy that's been stealing copier paper for the last 6 months? Aren't I the guy that's talking behind my boss's back with all the other employees about how they're doing everything wrong? Aren't I the guy that's really not doing a good job at work? And maybe I'm doing a good job at my current job. Maybe that was before, you know, I'm sober now and I'm living a cleaner life. But when I look at my last 10 jobs, what kind of an employee have I been? Based on my track record, shouldn't I probably be afraid? I'm afraid she's going to leave. I'm afraid she's going to leave. Well, how am I treating her? How do I show up in the relationship? Am I respectful or am I judgmental? Do I snap? Do I yell? Do I demand more than I'm entitled to? Do I expect her to behave in ways she can't behave? Am I unfaithful? Am I dishonest? Am I a liar? Based on my track record of my last 10 relationships, shouldn't I be afraid? when I look at the way that I've lived my life without God, when I look at the way I've lived my life based on self, when I look at how I show up in situations, isn't the evidence of my life that I should be afraid? I love this thing that Don said. It made me laugh when he said he looks at his 7 major relationships and he's 0 for 7, right? I love that. I started thinking to myself, what do we say in AA? Like, when we're talking amongst ourselves, what do we say about our relationships? We're not that honest. We say, what's my real problem? You know what my real problem is in relationships? I have a bad picker, yeah. Right? Yeah. Right? Like, Don's problem with his 0 and 7 is he picked the wrong 7 people, right? Right? I mean, aren't I that screwed up that's really what I think? The problem is that the truth is that Don met 7 wonderful people. Yep. And after they'd spent time with him, they became the devil themselves, right? Because that's the effect Don has on people, right? Right? And isn't that the truth about me in my life? That my self-centered fear, my desperate demand of people to make me feel in ways that it is unreasonable for me to make them feel, whether it's my parents, my friends, my family, the people at the home group, the people I work with, or the people that I'm in a relationship with, isn't it that my empty, squirmy fear, my demand for satisfaction from other people turns me into this guy that gets the dream job and 6 months later can't believe I work at a place like this? Gets the dream girl, and 6 months later, I can't believe I'm stuck with this crazy lunatic, right? Goes to the home group, and 6 months later, I want a business meeting because there's things we're just not doing right here. That my emptiness drives me to this. Fear is the thing that is the cause of most of the problems in my life. If resentment is the machine that destroys my life, fear is the fuel that I put in that machine to make that machine operate. There is AA folklore that I understand where it comes from, but it doesn't feel right for me. And it might feel right for you, but it doesn't feel right for me. This idea that if I can find a connection to God, I'll no longer be afraid. There's a joke that used to go around that people would share in meetings. They'd say, you know, when fear knocks at the door, if faith answers, there's nobody there, right? Which would make me feel like I'm doing something wrong. Because I think I got a pretty decent dose of faith. I mean, I don't need a tambourine. We're not pitching a tent nowhere. But I kind of dig God, and I think he digs me, and I trust him. I think he's got my back. I mean, it seems like the evidence of my life is that God's on my side. And I believe that everything's going to work out if I take the right action. I got a lot of faith. I don't have self-reliance. I got some God confidence. I really do. The experience of the last 21 years of my life is that God's on my side, and it's going to be okay. And I know that because it's always been okay. But I get afraid. I do. And if the answer, if the question is, if you're afraid, what's the solution? And the solution is faith. And if you have faith, fear disappears. Then I must be doing something wrong. Because with all the faith that I have, I am often afraid. I'm often driven to take actions that I wish I wouldn't have taken. I'm often locked up in my own head. I just get that way. So what does faith do for a guy like me then if it doesn't remove the fear? And I love this line at the end of the narrative on 68. It says, all men of faith have courage. They trust their God. They have courage. Well, what does courage mean? If the gift of faith is courage, it's not the absence of fear. Because if I wasn't afraid, I wouldn't need courage. Courage is a tool that scared men and women use to take the right action, not because they have no fear, but in spite of their fear. That my faith and trust in God allows me to do the right thing most of the time, scared to death. That scared to death, I can have the courage to take the right action. And it was such a relief for me to learn that that's what is going on for me. Because otherwise I start to second guess my relationship with God. If God loves me and I love God, I shouldn't be afraid. Well, I tell you, I'm afraid all the time. I started a new business a year ago, and boy, it's growing at a slow pace, not as quick as I need it to, boy. All right, I'm afraid of what my financial future is going to look like. I had an interesting thing. Some of you know this. I almost didn't make it this weekend. A week ago, I caught one of my top managers stealing from me, which is scary stuff in a business that's not really doing as well as it should. And now I'm afraid. I call Jody. I tell Jody, I'm afraid to leave my business. I don't think I can come. I can't leave it unattended. I got to be there. I got to do my job, right? I got to be there for the company. And until, I think, Thursday, I finally said, okay, I'll come, right? And scared to death, I sent Jody a text, and my text just said this: clean house, trust God, go to Alabama. And because I got to act like a guy that trusts God. The trick for me is not to wait until I'm not afraid. It's to act like God's on my side even though I'm afraid. And then God shows up. God shows up. And that seems to be my experience. Sexual inventory is the place in my life where if you were to say that the problem that I have is resentment and anger that is fired by self-centered fear, it is true that you can find that in my work life. It is true you can find that in my family life. It is true you can find that in my platonic relationships. But boy, somehow you get me in a sexual relationship, and it is at that point where the resentment and the fear and all the squirmy emotions, there's more, it seems like there's more at risk. So I think Bill has me do this sexual inventory because it is such a magical place for me to really look at all the things in my life, all the areas of self, all the places where I am driven. And it is the place in my life that we don't want to talk about. It's the place that we keep in the dark. What's that old joke, right? That sex is something that is beautiful and mystical and magical that you only do with someone that you love in the dark when nobody's watching, all right? Because we don't want to talk about it. We don't want to talk about it. And we all have sex problems. We'd hardly be human if we didn't. It is why I'm the most vulnerable and the most afraid. And what a great place for me to examine my selfishness and my judgment and when I'm in creating jealousy and suspicion and the like. And we're all a mess in this area. I tell you, it's a crazy, crazy thing that we do sometimes. We come to AA and we ask broken people, right, the one area of our lives where we're the biggest mess, we ask each other for advice. And I love this hysterical thinking or advice. I am so sure what you should do in every area of your life and so ashamed and confused about what I should do in every area of my life. But I think the key to all of this leads us right into step five. That in every area of my life, whether it's resentment or fear, my sexual conduct or misconduct, that I am transparent with someone. Not with everyone, right? I don't recommend anybody writes their fourth step and then shares their fifth step next time they're asked to talk, right? I'm glad we're all here together. I'm gonna tell you all my dark secrets. But there is somebody in my life, one person in my life. My sponsor, some of you know my sponsor is Bob D from Las Vegas. And there is absolutely nothing about my life that Bob doesn't know. And I got a couple of other close friends in my life that are like that. Don is one of those men. There is nothing about my life that Don doesn't know. Because I think that for me to feel whole and connected with God, there has to be another person that I'm able to look in the eye and that knows all of that stuff about me. And that knows and understands the things that are driving me, the fears, the regrets, the angst, the shame, the guilt, the remorse, all of that stuff, all of that stuff. Over on Over on page 73, it talks about taking inventory. Or at the bottom of 72, it says, time after time, newcomers have tried to keep to themselves certain facts about their lives, trying to avoid this humbling experience. They've turned to easier methods. Almost invariably, they got drunk. Having persevered with the rest of the program, they wondered why they fell. We think the reason is that they never completed their house cleaning. They took inventory, all right, but they hung on to some of the worst items in stock. They only thought they had lost their egotism and fear. They only thought they had humbled themselves, but they'd not learned enough of humility, fearlessness, and honesty. In a sense, we find it necessary until they told someone their whole life story. One of the emotions, one of the feelings, one of the things about me when I was new to Alcoholics Anonymous that I didn't really know until you said it, and you put a name on it, and the minute you said it and you put a name on it, I knew it was true. I felt separate. I felt this loneliness, this difference, this apart, anxious apartness that 12 and 12 talks about, that made me feel like I didn't really fit in this world. And because I felt separate, and because I felt alone, and because I felt this anxious apartness, I had to try and figure out why, and I did it through judgment of you. I had to constantly be looking at why we were different. What is it about us? What are you doing wrong? What are you doing right? Are you better than me? Are you worse than me? Never are you the same as me. Because I had to try and figure out what it was that kept me so alone from you. And through step five, through examining what it is about me, not that what is different, but in this four-step journey of this was our course, what I think is so important in the inventory, of finding out how I'm like you. One definition of humility is realizing that I am no different than you, that we are the same, and that learning this sameness between us is the thing that ends separation. That learning how I'm like you, removing the smoke and the darkness and the fog from the room that separates me from you, but learning how we are together, how we're joined in this journey, is the thing that reduces the separation. And if I can't reduce the separation between you and me, I'll never reduce the separation between me and God. There's that old American Indian poem, right, that says, I sought my God and he eluded me. I sought myself, I could not see. I sought my brother and there I found all three. And it is by realizing how we are alike, how we are the same, in this journey of step four and five, that I become the one thing that I so desperately need. I become part of you again. I'm this guy the book says that likes to live the double life, that I think I need to be more than I am because I don't feel like I'm enough, because I feel like somehow I don't measure up, then I have to create this character of who I think you need me to be, this lie, this story about Sheldon that is enough, and then I spend my life trying to prop it up. Like those old, there's a guy in my home group that talks about this. He was popular in the 80s and 90s, these guys with the poles with the plate on top. And they'd spin the plate, right? And they got to run from pole to pole and keep the plate spinning. And if a plate ever slows down, it teeters and falls off the pole. And I'm the guy that's running around my life trying to prop up the story, trying to keep the plate spinning. It's exhausting. It's exhausting. So I write all this stuff down and I go to share this stuff. And who do I share this stuff with? I'm born into a Jewish home. And in the Jewish faith, we have a way that we're supposed to deal with this stuff. My wife is a Catholic girl. And in the Catholic faith, there's a way that you're supposed to deal with this stuff. In the Catholic faith, the goal, from what I understand, and if you're Catholic and I say this wrong, believe me, it's just because I don't know and I'm talking about stuff I don't know, which is not unlike me, you have to know. I'm a guy that gets 10% of the information and makes up the rest. It's just the story of my life. But in the Catholic faith, you go to confession, you go sit with a priest and you share the stuff with the priest, and it's a beautiful thing to do. In our big book, it says that there are three things that this person should be. They should be closed-mouthed, right? They should be closed-mouthed. They should be understanding. and they should not try to change our plan. So in the Catholic faith, there's some amazing priests that are AA friendly that you could share an inventory with, and they would be closed mouth. They would never say anything, and that's valuable. And they would be understanding. I mean, they're men of the cloth. Most clergy are very compassionate, kind people. They would be understanding. And because they're AA informed, they wouldn't try to change your plan. But if they weren't AA informed, they might say, well, then you can say these prayers, you can do these rituals, and then you don't have to worry about steps 6, 7, 8, 9, and 10, because God loves you, you're forgiven, don't worry about it. In the Jewish faith, once a year, because now Catholics, I think you're supposed to do confession regularly, right? How often are you supposed to do confession? Any Catholics? Every week. See, Jews, we don't pay retail. We do everything wholesale. So we only do it once a year. First of all, we're not as bad as you. But once a year between New Year and the Day of Atonement, between Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, we're supposed to contemplate all of our sins and think about the wrongs that we've done. And then the story goes that at Yom Kippur, we do the one thing that Jews never do, which is we don't eat. We fast for a day. And then we take some bread and we say some prayers over the bread. And then we sprinkle the bread and we put the sins in the bread, is what we do. And then we go to a stream or a river and we sprinkle the sin-laden bread in the stream or the river, and the stream takes it away, and then we are forgiven. Now, the weird thing about that is that the home of Judaism, of course, is Israel, which is a desert where there aren't a lot of streams or rivers. So they came up with another way of doing it, where what you actually do now is you get a sacrificial goat, and you say the prayers over the bread, and then you sprinkle the bread into the goat's fleece, and then you spank the goat on the ass, and the goat runs out of the village, and you are forgiven. Unless one of your sins is spanking goats' asses, and then you're in this terrible cycle that is just is never ending. Never, never, never ending. Yeah, you're a goat spanker, Landis. There's nothing we can do about it. But very, very quickly, these three things that are vital. And this is more of a conversation, not for a guy who's getting ready to share his fifth step, but let's have a conversation about the guy that's getting, or the gal that's getting ready to hear a fifth step. Because all joking aside and all humor aside, this closed-mouthed friend, Dr. Bob talked about that evil member, the tongue, the gossip that we do in AA, the talking about each other. So, you know, we temper it with kindness and love, the 12 and 12 says. Here's the problem with gossip in AA. I'm getting ready to share my fifth step with you, and I hear you after the meeting talking about somebody that's not there. Oh, you know, old Bill, I think he's cheating on his at work again. He's beating on his kids. I think he was flirting with that girl. You know, that's inappropriate. And we gossip a little bit about each other. Or even worse, I'm sponsoring a guy and I'm sponsoring you, and I talk to you about the other guy that I'm sponsoring. I kind of hint her. I mean, I'm smarter than to outright tell you, but I hint around a little bit about something you've said. The danger with that is that now I need to share something secret. We laugh that we you know, you're as sick as your secrets. There are things in my life sometimes that require to be kept in a confidence. There just are. And if I was afraid that my sponsor might share that confidence, I wouldn't be able to share my stuff with him. That if I can't trust the person I'm giving my fifth step to, or my 10th step to, or that I'm sharing my life with, I might hold back. And it warns earlier on in the book here, it says that if I don't share everything, I might drink again. And so we have a responsibility as AA members. We have a responsibility not to gossip. So when people come to us to share things, they will share openly and completely with us. I need to be a closed mouth friend. What else do I need to be? I need to be an understanding friend. Boy, I went through a phase about 4 or 5 years sober. Or if you came to me with stuff, I was the poke you in the chest guy. Well, you know, you shouldn't do that, kid. That's wrong. You should know better, should behave better. What's the matter with you? You can't behave that way. Very judgmental. I hope I have learned, and I really hope I continue to learn more about compassion in Alcoholics Anonymous. That my goal is not only to be closed-mouthed, but to come, when guys come to me, to be able to be loving and kind and understanding, to make them feel comfortable and safe. Isn't that what I really need out of a sponsor? A safe place to go. A safe place to go. There's a big difference between sharing everything in a fifth step and sharing everything but one or two things. And there is a responsibility on both sides of this equation. And one responsibility is on the guy sharing his fifth step, that he be prepared to share everything. And the other responsibility is on the person hearing the fifth step, that he present himself or herself in a way where they're closed mouth and understanding, and they allow that person the honor of being able to share everything with them. But I agree with what Don said, that there is a great relief that comes from step five, but it is temporary. I like to think of it as if I'm doing my laundry, right? Which I don't do very often. My wife tells me about the experience of doing laundry, so this is really her, I'm kidding. Don't roll your eyes at me, I'm kidding. But when you do laundry, if you've got a pile of dirty, stinky clothes, and if you think about my life as a pile of dirty, stinky clothes, and I take them and I put them in the washing machine, and I put some of that fancy smelling soap in there, right? And I wash the clothes. When they're done washing, which is like step four and five is like the wash cycle, when they're done washing, right? If you open up the washing machine, they look brighter, they smell cleaner, right? We're getting there, aren't we? But if I close the washing machine door and I just let them sit in there, what's going to happen? They're going to get worse. They're going to be stinkier and moldy and dirty and worse. I would rather put on a dirty shirt than a shirt that sat in the washing machine for a week, wouldn't you? Right? So what do I do next? I take them out of the washing machine and I either put them in the dryer or maybe I don't, does anybody hang them on the clothesline anymore? Maybe I hang them on the clothesline, right? But I got to go through the drying cycle in order to make those clothes clean and fresh and wearable. And that's what 6, 7, 8, and 9 are. They're the drying cycle. It's completing the wash. And that's why this danger of people stalling at step five, it does make us worse. You can get sicker if you do five and stop. And there are people sober a long time. And I'll tell you this, and we'll take a break, and this maybe you know people like this. I hope it's not your experience, but it may be. I have people come to me often that are sober a long time that want help. And they're sober and they're not drinking, but they're frustrated and their lives aren't what it needs to be. And I will tell you the first question I ask them, right after I ask them, how many new people are you working with? The first question I ask them is, did you stop at five? Do you have unmade amends? Are there amends that you should have made that you haven't yet? And I tell you every time it's getting through five and thinking that, oh, okay, I'm done now, and not moving on with the rest of the stuff that causes the problem.